Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Yannick Nezet-Séguin, the new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns looks back to Yannick's first visit to Philadelphia, and Susan Lewis takes us to ancient Rome. The latest exhibition at the National Constitution Center examines how the classical influence helped shape America. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
After a 3.5-year search, the Philadelphia Orchestra has a new artistic leader. Yannick Nezet-Séguin is currently music director of the Rotterdam Philharmonic, principal guest conductor of the London Philharmonic, and principal conductor of the Metropolitan Orchestra of Montreal. The orchestra has been without a leader since Christoph Eschenbach stepped down more than 2 years ago. The veteran Swiss conductor Charles Dutoit has been acting as chief conductor in the interim. Yesterday, Yannick was part of a whirlwind of activities to unveil him to the orchestra's subscribers, local dignitaries and the city at large. He also spent time visiting many city landmarks and attended a Philadelphia Orchestra neighbourhood concert in Upper Derby. But before all of that, we caught up with him at his Center City Hotel. So your appointment was announced on Sunday, at which point every one of us began pronouncing your name incorrectly. Let me have a swing at it. Yannick Nezet-Séguin.
It is perfection. You know, that's the only thing I can say. Whenever I read the phonetic pronunciation that, you know, newspapers try to put, it's always slightly funny. But what you just did is perfect.
We can take that as official then. We knew about it on Sunday. When did you finally make the decision that you would accept the offer to become the 8th music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra?
I cannot make a definite moment about it. I think that's been an ongoing process since I first fell in love with the orchestra at the very, very first moment back in December 2008 when I came to conduct a Tchaikovsky Pathétique. And from that point onwards, there was a process of getting closer, I would say. And it's somewhere in the past few months, obviously, that I had to give a lot of reflection about how I could envision my future with this orchestra. And the only thing I can say today is how exciting and thrilling and moving it is for me to make that decision.
You say you fell in love with the orchestra, but there was a certain reciprocal arrangement there. The same thing happened in Rotterdam. You came for not more than 2 or 3 guest conducting visits, 2 visits here. Can you tell us, is there something in the water, or do you have a magic wand? How do you get orchestras to instantly decide that they want to spend time with you?
I guess the important elements with this, two things, is that it all has to start from this chemistry in the music. I think my role, my responsibility, my primary responsibility as an interpreter, as a musician, is to serve the composer. But as a conductor is not only to lead, but it's a blend between leading and serving the musicians, enabling them to express themselves. So in doing so, I guess it has a lot to do with who are the human beings there and how they respond to my way as a human being to share that music. And the only secret I have, I guess, is probably just to try to be as honest as possible and remain myself. Because both Rotterdam and Philadelphia, I was, of course, aware that there was a search going on. But there's no need and no point in trying to be different because there's a search. I think it comes down to just be yourself, make music, be very honest, and I believe strongly that this is what musicians everywhere in the world expect.
It's very different though from days of old where the maestro was on a podium both literally and figuratively. You keep yourself very accessible to the musicians. They can wander into your dressing room. You can have casual conversations related to what happens on the stage. Was that a conscious decision, or is that, again, just a part of who you are?
It's definitely a part of what I believe in life. What I believe music is something which cannot happen. I cannot envision music happening under tension, under something that would shut off the primary energy and the gift of music that we have to give for the audience. And of course, we're talking about generations. Maybe there's a difference, but my main influence, for example, is Carlo Maria Giulini. And Giulini himself, who was completely of another age, was accessible, was a grand old man, very noble, but he was never someone who would be aggressive with anyone and would respect every musician. And that's at the very core of what I believe. With respect, if I respect the musicians and I respect the music, I think I will earn their respect. And I think, therefore, we'll earn the respect and even more love from the audience.
At what point, though, do you have to get a bit tougher? Or is there a tougher version of YNS?
Of course. I mean, because respect and love, it's a little bit like a father and mother with their children. I mean, when you love someone, you also have to be strict and have... And musicians know that. It's not all about being always smiling and say, oh, it's great, it's fantastic. No. Of course, first and foremost, I have to do my job. And a big part of this job is the control aspect of where we are going together and giving some parameters along the way. But I strongly believe that this can be done in a very strict way, but respectful. And that's the key element.
You mentioned Giulini, but Charles Dutoit was also an influence on you in your early days. And you also, I believe, listened to Philadelphia Orchestra recordings as a child. So you were connected with the place even before you got here.
Yes, it very much feels like this now that I'm seeing, at age 35, my background and my road up to now. When I look back, then I see all these elements coming together. I remember also loving the city of Philadelphia as a kid because I loved geography. And whenever we would discuss about American cities, I said, oh, I love the city. I had no idea about the city, but I had the idea about the orchestra, and I loved the orchestra. And it's true that Dutoit was very important in my initial vision of what is a conductor, what does that do in life. And one aspect that I like to quote is also the fact that the orchestra was very present in the community, and he was, as a conductor, very accessible. He was speaking before the concerts in parks, and that was crucial, I think, for me as a little boy of 9 years old, to see how, to be able to share or to have a little snippets of what it is to be a conductor. And that's why today, that's part of the reason why today I'm who I am.
Most of us, when we're 9 years of age, want to be a train driver or a firefighter. That's a pretty lofty career decision to make age nine. Did you ever have any doubts thereafter? You learned piano, you're a singer as well?
Yes, I did the usual path of astronaut and fireman, and that was before. I even wanted to be a priest before a conductor, so you can make connections if you like. After the conducting, I had temptations. Lawyer, economist, journalist.
God forbid.
Not music critic. But there was never a strong temptation. Architect was maybe the strongest. And I think the connection with what we're doing, especially in symphonic music, with all this, yes, architecture,
sure,
of the works, that has a connection definitely with it. But no, I never really seriously questioned my career from age 10 to where I am now.
Why not pianist, why not singer?
When I finished my studies at the conservatoire, my piano teacher, I remember, she said that, you know, she made me think again about this because she knew about the conducting thing. And she said, you know, if you would like, you would really, you know, I see you that you could become a pianist, really, if you wanted. But I think what I enjoy about what I'm doing and where I feel I serve the most, my art and the people around me, is when I'm surrounded by fantastic musicians and I can just inspire them, hopefully, or enabling them to really express the core of the music. And that, I'm sure, that will happen in Philadelphia in the next few years.
Final question. They're making motions to us to finish. To what extent does the singing then, is it a part of the conducting? We often hear conductors singing quietly under their breath when they're conducting. Are you?
I'm not aware if I'm singing while I'm breathing a lot, and I think that a human voice is so connected to every instrument we're playing, except maybe timpani. And even timpani, you know, there's some pitches and there's some really nice lines. So I strongly believe in the connection between breathing and conducting. So therefore, yes, it's singing my heart.
Yannick Nezet-Segan, music director designate of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He was offered this position despite only having conducted the orchestra in two programs. But even before he arrived in Philadelphia just a year and a half ago, there was a buzz about this then relatively unknown young conductor. Here's what the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reported for us in November 2008.
American Airlines baggage representative, please come to the baggage claim area in Terminal A East for passenger assistance.
It's a balmy late Tuesday night at the Philadelphia Airport F terminal where conductor Yannick Nezet-Segan is hours late on the eve of his first rehearsal with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Illness kept him at home in Montreal an extra day. Snow and freezing rain grounded his flight interminably. One of the most important engagements of his still young career would seem to be turning into a cliffhanger.
Excuse me, Yannick.
Yes.
David Stearns.
You're here.
Yes, I am.
You survived. You survived and you decided.
Yes. Yeah. Come here, I'll show you something.
I walk him over to a lighted sign that hangs over the security checkpoint entrance showing the Kimmel Center, where he will conduct.
That's where you're going.
That's great. Okay, that cheers me up.
Yeah, have you been there?
No, actually.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay, well, somebody said it looks like a giant slinky, you know?
No, it's great, yeah. I feel. But, I mean.
As we headed into the limo, he filled me in on all the heady activities coming his way of late. He'll conduct new productions at the Metropolitan Opera the next three seasons, in addition to his 8 weeks in Rotterdam, 4 weeks in London, and as many weeks as possible in Montreal. That's where he has enjoyed the unique opportunity of making his career in his hometown with the full support of his parents, a pair of retired teachers, plus his three cats. He's a compact, hardy, sometimes spiky-haired Quebecois who loves a cold beer after a performance, has none of the typical conductor imperiousness, but seems to have no problem inspiring musicians to follow his lead, so to speak. The Rotterdam Orchestra had the charismatic Valery Gergiev for years, but after only three programs with Yannick, the Dutch don't bother much with his last name anymore, he was unanimously voted in.
I remember in the second visit feeling almost shocked by how insistent and how extraordinarily intense these people were. I remember one of the violinists, an extraordinary lady, who just took me by the shoulders and looked at me and said, "You belong to us."
It was that can be rather frightening.
Yes, it was frightening. It's a very intense group.
The Philadelphia Orchestra liked this young conductor right away, but often he'll be in his first rehearsal with an orchestra and wondering if the group likes him at all, while the management is already negotiating his re-engagement. Amidst all of this, his anchor is knowing what he wants with the music and going after it.
That's the most difficult thing, to try and be yourself and natural and exchanging this. And of course, this will be a lifetime journey for me. However, I always am amazed at how I am welcomed. And I never feel that there's this... Or not even for very long, there's this attitude of who's that kid and what does he want? Who does he think he is?
Sizing up Yannick Nezet-Segan takes a while, partly because the only other American orchestra he's conducted is the National Symphony, and his recordings with Orchestra Metropolitain du Grand Montréal have been hard to find up until recently. His repertoire is a little crazy. He'll conduct a Nino Rota film score as a concert piece, but lest we think he's a young man in a hurry, he conducts some of the most contemplative Bruckner ever. His pedigree isn't typical. Much of his training was in choral music conducting at Westminster College in Princeton. He has performed a lot of Bach that other conductors say for old age. So you're not surprised to find that one of his mentors was the guru-like conductor Carlo Maria Giolini.
I was aware what he was creating was magic, and I was aware that it was ridiculous of me trying to put some kind of analytic organization to something magic. However, that's what I was trying to do. So I was trying to copy Bowens. I was trying to note everything he would say. But when we had our private sessions, I would always, now that I look at this, I feel almost ashamed, because I was always talking about very young conductor problems. And what was disconcerting is that he was always treating me as a colleague and getting the answer back in myself and not him, in a very clever way, but in a very, such a respectful way, which in the end gave me a lot of confidence.
That confidence, plus the fact that, having decided to become a conductor at age 10, he's more seasoned than he looks, Yannick Nezet-Séguin occasionally seems to conduct himself into a corner. Sometimes, one of his interpretive ideas will gather so much intensity, such as in this live Rotterdam performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, that it's hard for him to find his way back to the overall flow of the piece.
I mean, I've never felt that, oh my God, what have I done? It's out of control. I've never felt that. But I felt sometimes that, yes, I was trying that shape. It informed me on, I thought I would explore something more about the piece. And then the next day I decided, no, I recently we did 4 times Beethoven 7. And I thought the orchestra, like every orchestra, was a bit dragging in this. So I decided this would go really quick. And it worked for one night. But I was well aware then that, is it really what I feel is really the most true to the piece? No, I think I went overboard. But it doesn't matter to go overboard one night in the grand scheme of things. And I'm glad we did it together. And the next night, it was more organic.
Classical people agree, in theory, that such risk-taking is necessary to keep the great masterpieces living and breathing. Surprisingly, few conductors can actually get away with it, at least as well as Nezet-Séguin does. It's always wonderful to have a talented young conductor in our midst. One German critic called this one Das Wunder Yannick, and this one, indeed, seems to be something that the world needs.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stern's report on Yannick's first visit to Philadelphia in November 2008.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Today, ancient Rome is known to scholars and students of the classics. Tourists drawn to Italy and perhaps fans of Shakespeare and popular movies such as Gladiator. But in the mid-1700s, the culture of ancient Rome was woven into every formal education and became a critical frame of reference for America's founding fathers. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores an exhibition at the National Constitution Center, Ancient Rome and America, the classical influence that shaped our nation.
Greeting visitors is a golden eagle with wings spread, perched on a cupola taken from the roof of a 19th century American school. Next to it is the head of another eagle from a Roman military standard that was likely carried into battle. Exhibit developer Sarah Winsky says this opening display of two versions of one familiar symbol was chosen to crystallize what this exhibition is all about.
The strong ties that we have to ancient Rome that are all around us that you don't always think about or realize.
Two civilizations separated by language, oceans, and more than 2,000 years of history, spanning nearly a millennium, ancient Rome was a kingdom which became a republic which turned into an empire. Just a couple of centuries old today, America, with its roots in monarchy, was founded as a republic, and it expanded geographically and culturally, some say, into its own empire, without the emperors. Although some American leaders were fond of that Roman look.
I was actually shocked at the idea that in many of his statues, George Washington is wearing a toga.
David Eisner is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, where one bust of America's first president has folded drapes around the shoulders of his colonial dress.
And you might even, if you weren't thinking about it, look at the statue and not consciously notice it. But once you start calling these things to conscious attention, it's riveting how explicit the connections are.
Washington wasn't the only one, but it's important to note that these early American statesmen were emulating not the emperors, but the leaders of the republic, who all wore togas. Eisner likens the ideological underpinnings of the American Constitution to ideas dating back to ancient Rome.
The emergence of the republic, the fear of authoritarianism, and some of the philosophical elements.
America's founders were quite familiar with the culture and history of Rome. Constitution Center Director of Exhibits Stephanie Ryer says for them, the Romans were like old friends.
They were all brought up with a classical education. They were reading Plutarch and Tacitus and Livy. Their heroes were all classical heroes, from Cincinnatus through Cicero.
There was also a practical aspect to the study of ancient history, says co-curator Carolyn Winterer, associate professor of American history at Stanford University.
You would learn the fine art of oratory, of how to be a persuasive public speaker at a time when there's no radio, no television, no internet, very few people read newspapers. How do you communicate effectively with people? Well, you imitate Cicero. How do you establish a workable form of government? Well, look at what the ancient Romans are doing.
America's founders did look at ancient Rome. After all, its republic, with its separation of powers, its elite senate and consuls, and elected assemblies, had lasted nearly 500 years. But when Americans formed their republic,
they broke away ultimately from the Roman model because they said that power ultimately in every branch of government resides in the people. And that's very distinct from the Roman model.
But the influence of Rome on America went way beyond governance. In the mid-1700s, the excavation of the ancient cities buried by lava, Pompeii and Herculaneum, fueled a neoclassical revival. Americans and Europeans were fascinated by the detailed archaeological finds that shed insight into Roman life. There was, says Winterer, a kind of Roman mania in art and architecture, which lasted through the late 19th century.
It wasn't just about wallpaper and columns, but they dressed in ancient Greco-Roman style. And we have an example here of what was called a Grecian robe. Josephine, the wife of Napoleon Bonaparte, who was a trendsetter, wore it. But so did Dolly Madison, the wife of James Madison. And we have examples of neoclassical jewelry that American women wore. We have examples of Greco-Roman sofas and chairs that Americans decorated their houses with.
The 8,000-square-foot exhibition explores the many ways ancient Rome has found expression in American culture up to the present day. The increasing number of discovered connections surprised even the members of the exhibition team, like Linda Carioni in international relations for the Italian partner Contemporanea Progetti.
A lot of the comparisons that were developed by the National Constitution Center brought to the surface things all of us from the Italian side found very interesting and were not aware of ourselves. So in that case, it's been sort of perhaps a learning process for both teams.
The over 240 Roman and more than 90 American objects are exhibited together to illustrate similarities, from sculpted busts honoring leaders to side-by-side slave collars. Another section includes two documents granting citizenship to former soldiers, one a Roman bronze tablet, the other a set of naturalization papers from 1864. There are grand public symbols in sculpture, paintings, and architecture, as well as more intimate references, such as the Revolution-era letters from Abigail Adams to her husband John, signed simply Portia, recalling the wife of the Roman Senator Brutus who helped assassinate Julius Caesar when he threatened the Republic.
The identity was great for both of them. It helped to link her in her own mind to the ideals of the American Revolution, and it helped to reassure John that his wife was still on board.
America adopted Roman ideas and adapted them in ways both obvious and subtle. In a copy of what is now known as the 1796 Lansdowne portrait of George Washington, the president stands in 18th century dress in orator's pose. Co-curator Cam Gray is an assistant professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania.
If you look at the laurel wreath on the back of the chair, that's a very powerful symbol of victory, of course. If you look at the table leg, you'll see that there's a bundle of sticks that are bound together by fibers. Now, this is an evocation of something that we call the fasces. The fasces was a bundle of rods that had axes inside them, and they were bound together and they were carried in front of the Roman magistrate.
No less important are the smaller connections, then and now. Gray points to the significance of the discoveries of Pompeii and Herculaneum to the founding fathers.
All of a sudden, these wonderful things started coming out of the ground, and they were so real and so tangible. There were pots and pans. It's all very well to look at a bust or a statue of a powerful figure, and we can be moved by the grandeur and by the power of it, but it's the littlest things that really grab you. It's the things where you say, wow, they had mirrors just like us. They darned their clothes with needles just like us.
The exhibition tracks both cultures through their respective histories, each building a republic, expanding its territories, and dealing with an increasingly diverse population. Comparisons continue into contemporary times. A Philadelphia Eagles football helmet, alongside a gladiator helmet, suggests the power of sports to harness and express public passions, calling to mind the Roman poet Juvenal's lament that people want no more than bread and circuses. Movie posters and music dramatize the Roman era. The Roman Republic turned into an empire, which finally ended, although scholars may debate how, why, and exactly when. But with so many parallels to the complexities of contemporary America, Carolyn Winterer says today, in the wake of 9/11, it's fair to ask, are we Rome? Are we an empire?
You can make some compelling arguments that America is an empire. We have an expansive territory. We defend it militarily. We expand culture and, we export American culture throughout the world. The Romans did the same thing.
And the Romans worried about being an empire. They worried about the implications of governing a vast area. These concerns, these worries about what it means to be militarily, culturally, economically, politically preeminent are concerns that are really interestingly paralleled between these two societies.
This show does not provide answers, nor does it suggest that Rome's fate foreshadows ours. Instead, it prompts thoughtful reflection about the benefits and dangers of powerful nations, no matter how old, how young, or how grand.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Rome and America is at the National Constitution Center through August 1st. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.